So I'm here at Trinity College Dublin, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by the author John Grogan, who's here for a very special event, a talk and a series of lectures to students. Many of you will know him from his best-selling novel and the well-known film Marley and Me, but he was a writer long before that. Welcome to the Art Show, John.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And so, you know, there's no such thing as an overnight success, the old adage goes. And you were writing as a newspaper columnist for a long time before you had this huge hit with Marley and Me.
That's right. In fact, a lot of people think like I just came out of nowhere. This guy just decided to write a book and it took off and became this number one bestseller. But in reality, I've been working towards a career as a book writer since I was in college as a young person. I majored in both English and journalism, and I was doing a lot of creative writing along with my journalism, and then got out into the world of newspapers and was writing journalism, but was also desiring to write fiction. And at a certain point, I figured out that you could combine the two into that hybrid genre of literary journalism and write in a narrative nonfiction form. So I was doing that as a journalist for a long time, which is a very similar form to how you write a book. So by the time I realized what the story I was meant to tell, the story of my wife and myself as young people with this crazy dog in our midst, I had been working for 20-some years working on my narrative nonfiction form.
And of course, one of the most difficult things, as anyone who comes to write knows, is the application of bottom to seat. And so as a journalist, of course, you're doing that kind of like going to the gym almost of delivering the words and putting in that work. So it becomes second nature.
It does. I worked as a journalist. I worked really well under deadlines. Some people don't like them. But for me, it just, you know, I started when I was 21. And I formed to respond well to deadlines. So the adrenaline of that moment and the pressure and knowing that no matter what happened, I had to turn something in by 6 p.m. really worked for me. When I was sort of at the height as a newspaper columnist, I was doing 3 columns a week, and each one was about 600 or 700 words. And I just loved the rhythm of that. And then I would turn it in, go home, and the next morning I would open up my email and I would have this very accurate barometer of how I hit with the public. Some days I had 6 or 7 emails and I knew that I'd missed. And other days I would have 60 or 200. And that told me that somehow I connected with people on a human level.
Well, that's really a gift if you can have that kind of feedback from your audiences as you're going on. Finding something to write about can sometimes be the struggle. Did you feel that pressure as a columnist from week to week, wondering, I need something to happen to me?
All the time, all the time. For me, the biggest struggle of being a successful columnist was coming up with an idea that worked. And then the second biggest challenge was to have something to say about it. And that was fairly easy for me to solve because once I picked a topic, I soon learned that the more I reported the topic, the more legwork I did and actually got out of the office and talked to real people, I had a lot of material in my notebook, and those are building blocks of good story. When you sit in the office in a vacuum and decide you're going to write about topic X, then that's a formula for pontificating and just a lot of hot air emanating from the writer. So it was that constant churn of trying to find 3 good ideas a week. And I thought of it as in kind of a baseball metaphor. You know, sometimes you hit a single, sometimes you hit a home run, but you never wanted to strike out. And I think I got some singles, but I don't think I ever really struck out.
And so what makes a good column? And then to come on to, obviously, what makes an amazing column, because Marley and Me was originally based on one of your columns and was, you got such a response to it, that's what led to the book.
Exactly. So the earlier part of my career, I was an investigative reporter, a hard news reporter, and very much trying to keep myself out of it as a person, be strictly objective. And then when I became a columnist, my boss was saying, you know, now is your turn to like bring your personality in and your opinion. And that was really hard for me. At first, my early columns were very much like short little news stories in a column format, which is really not what they're supposed to be. But gradually I learned that the more I put myself into it and my personal experience and my personal prism, the more readers responded to me, and not just in numbers, but also at a very human level. The more emotional or my own emotions I saw, the more that I would talk about how my experience as a husband, father, member of the community affected my outlook. It built this strong relationship with readers. And that was all good training for writing a memoir, where to do it successfully, you really have to take your armor off and be vulnerable and just be willing to tell your story.
And so talk about the Marley column then, when you wrote that.
You know, Marley was in our lives for 13 years. And if you only saw the movie Marley and Me, you would be under the impression that all I did was write about Marley, which of course isn't true. I think he got about a dozen columns over 6 years. So a couple a year, I'd trot him out. And they were always funny columns and people laughed. And I knew there was comedy in this situation with this dog. But when we lost him, when he finally died at the age of 13 as a very old dog, I felt real grief. I mean, really real grief, just like when you lose a family member. And two, I felt bad that for 13 years I'd been trotting him out to tell these funny stories about how we got the world's worst dog and there should be a return policy and, you know, all tongue in cheek. But he was really a good-hearted soul, and he was a great member of our family with a lot of love and loyalty. And so I wanted to tell the whole story. So I wrote that one final column about Marley where I said goodbye to him. And I talked about what a pain he was and what a crazy, manic, out-of-control dog as a younger dog he was, but also about all the sweet and loyal moments and how he protected our children and, you know, just really loved his family and was so gentle with the babies and all of that stuff. And so that column really came out of my heart, and I wasn't thinking about a book at that time. I was thinking of just telling this. But the next day, as I talked about, and you know, the next morning you get responses, 800 people weighed in with highly emotional responses to this column. And that's when I really knew that I had more than just a string of funny anecdotes about a crazy dog. I had the story of a couple in formation, and it had a beginning, us getting married and getting a little house and bringing this dog home. And then it had a 13-year arc of narrative of us moving through life, trying to figure this out. And it had an ending with us saying goodbye to Marley and realizing that he had forced us to grow as human beings.
I mean, it is a heartbreaking story. I mean, I cried when I read it. But I think what's so successful about it is that it's both serious and comic at the same time. And if you can... Stories are sometimes one or the other, but if you can nail both, I think that's why you get a number one bestseller.
Well, that has been observed by others as well. That, I mean, so much of the book is funny. There's a lot of funny moments, but it's about real lives. It's a true story about my wife and myself as newlyweds moving through adulthood. And so it not only has these comedic moments with our crazy dog, but it has pregnancy issues, a miscarriage, postpartum depression issues, and all the things that couples go through, and two career challenges, and for my wife, that feeling of the glass ceiling once you are a mother and you still want to work, but you need to juggle work with children, and the tone of the assignments change for you. She was very high-profile feature writer, and she felt like those assignments changed. So all these things get wrapped into this book. And it's a story of real lives, and they're both comedic and everything in between, as sad and heartbreak and heart joy. And that's the story without me really working to go for that on its own, just develop that cadence.
And was it challenging for you and your wife when it went to the kind of the level of success with Marley and Me to have your lives out there on the page? Or, you know, as you were talking about all the people responding to your personal stories, was it part of something bigger?
None of us were prepared for this. When I wrote Marley and Me, I knew I had an important story that important to me, and I was proud of it. But I really did think of it as a smaller book that would find a small, limited audience. Because, you know, it's just about two ordinary people. There was no There are no car chases, no explosions, none of that kind of thing. And then so when it became a number one bestseller and then went on to become a movie portraying us as with our real names and everything, it was on one hand of this wonderful roller coaster ride, but on another, it was it's a fairly scary and unsettling thing to have this juggernaut out of your control, really. It's almost like when you picture like the avalanche coming down the mountain and we're riding, you know, on top of the snow and hoping we don't get buried. And that's kind of what it felt like for about 3 years. It was a pretty long window. And, you know, it was every author's dream to have a book take off like that. But there was also a certain amount of exposure that for people who are fairly private is something that was, there was an adjustment there.
And were you involved in the film process as a writer or what was your involvement in that?
I was a consultant on the film and they brought in their own screenwriters and I'm happy they did because it's a whole different set of skills. And also, I think it would be very difficult for the writer of the book to write the screenplay because there's so much dismantling that goes on and changing in order to make a book work as a 90-minute movie. So I was reading the various versions of the script and marking them up and giving feedback and back and forth with the producer and the director. And I felt the process was respectful. I would say things, and if they didn't think they could do them, they would explain why. And in some cases, they accepted my recommendations. And we kind of inched our way towards a version that worked for them. And I also thought was fairly close to my original book and my true story.
So it was quite quick, really. Was it 2005? Was the book and 2009 was the film. That's pretty quick turnaround for the movie business, actually.
Yes, the book came out in October of 2005, and the next year, like in February, it hit number one on the bestseller list, and that's when books get attention by movie makers. And it came out at Christmas time of 2008. So it was just a few years. It was a pretty quick turnaround, and I was working on my second book, The Longest Trip Home. So I was juggling a lot. I was doing book tours for my book. I was doing some publicity for the movie coming. I was writing a book, and I was also working on some children's stories, which came to me somewhat accidentally because even though Marley and Me was written for adults, a lot of children were trying to read it, and it seemed too mature for them. And so I came out with a young reader's version of that.
So tell us a bit how it works in the young reader versions.
Well, I did two things for young readers. So at my different book appearances and readings, I would, you know, my book has a lot of mild adult content, couples trying to get pregnant and miscarriages and things that probably you don't want 10, 12-year-olds reading. But there would be all these little kids sitting on the floor in the front row when I give these readings from my book. And there are moms and dads looking somewhat uncomfortable, that their kids are trying to read my book. So the first thing I did was do an adaptation of Marley and Me for basically the age group of about 8 to 12. And it's the same basic story with some of the adult content stripped out and also simpler language structure. But not too simple. I wanted kids to strive a little bit and reach. And in addition to that, there were little kids coming and wanting to hear the funny dog stories. I mean, as little as 3, 4, 5 years old. And so my publisher suggested we try a picture book. And I remember I wrote it in London. I was in London on a book tour, and I was sitting in my hotel room on the weekends in between appearances working on this little simple story, which I thought would be so easy because they're short and they're big pictures. But it's like writing haiku a little bit. Every word has to count, and it's very easy to be too wordy in those. So I went through several drafts before I got it down. But that led to a book called Bad Dog Marley, which was a picture book for little kids. And that became a bestseller in both the UK and the United States. And then that led to, I think I did a total of 7 of these picture books. And in addition to that, the publisher did a spinoff of I Can Read books that were written by professional writers who write these young books for children learning to read. So they're very, very simple noun-verb form, declarative sentence form. But it was a whole series of Marley-themed books that I did not write. I just reviewed and okayed.
Well, it just shows you, I mean, what a universal story the loss of a dog, having a dog in your family is, and how wonderful that you have all these iterations, even to the point of encouraging young children to read because they want to know about the dog. I think that shows what a simple and successful idea that you had, but also the way in which you took that idea out. Really brilliant.
I was actually very surprised that children gravitated towards the Marley and Me story, because it's not a kid-centric story. It's really about their moms and dads and the dog. But they did. But it's funny that you say that about encouraging children to read. What I hear a lot is our wives who talk to me about, yours is the first book I got my husband to read. Like, he just doesn't read books, and what he reads is like technical things for his job. But I gave it this to him, and it was the first book he's read in several years. And I can't count the number of women who told me that thing. I like that. I like the fact that it might be a book that crosses over and brings in new readers who, if they like my book, they might then go on to understand the joy of reading a book and read other books as well.
That's really interesting. And actually, when a lot of men talk about their top 10 films, Shawshank Redemption's often at the top. And it's a very emotional film that in a manly way allows men to be emotional. So actually, this in a way has quite a similar thing, which is it's acceptable for men to read, but it allows them to be emotional. I don't know, maybe that's part of it.
I think it is. There is this sort of truth about males that it's not okay to cry about virtually anything in this world, in society, except the loss of your dog. And so men...
Old Yeller.
Exactly. Men feel this permission, like, it's okay, I'm still a strong man, I can cry about the loss of my buddy, my best friend, the dog. But if they had a loss of a loved one in their life, they need to be stoic and strong. That's their role. And unfortunately, it suppresses a lot of open emotion in men. So I think Marley and Me gave them permission to feel that emotional tug, and it did bring a lot of men into it.
So we've been talking about the readers of your work. To talk a little bit about the writing side, because you're here in Dublin as a guest lecturer and to give a talk, and you've been talking, I believe, to the children's writing program. Tell us a little bit about what you've been lecturing to the students about.
I've done a couple of different things. There's a really great, here at Trinity, Masters in Children's Literature, where they're studying children's lit starting from like the 1600s forward, I believe. And I did a roundtable with them, just telling my story about how, as I told you, how I somewhat accidentally got into children's writing. But I've also done some workshops with creative writing students here, both at the graduate level and undergraduate. They're mostly working on fiction, and what I specialize in is nonfiction. And the message I'm bringing, and I think we were all in agreement on it, is that good narrative nonfiction shares many of the same qualities of fiction writing, and indeed borrows from fiction. So you can use foreshadowing and narrative arc and building action and all these things that make for a good fictional story in a true story that's well reported and you're not exaggerating the truth. But you can tell that story in a way that's very compelling. And that was really what our discussions have been centering around here.
I suppose with true life, it's even more difficult. But what about the editing side of the process when you're shaping the narrative, whether fiction or nonfiction, to have a compelling story that makes people want to turn the page?
Fiction and nonfiction are a little different in that regard, in that with fiction, you can... Obviously, you're creating your story and your characters and the directions they're going to go. In nonfiction, you're dealing with real events that, if you're going to be ethical about it and call it nonfiction, you have to tell in a style that accurately or as accurately as you can captures that. That doesn't mean, though, that you can't shape those events and omit events that are not necessarily relevant. Your job is not to just publish diaries of every single event, starting with what time you had coffee in the morning. Yeah. It's to selectively pick the events that matter and to tell them in a way that leads to the next true event, and that one leads to the next one. And by doing that, and usually almost always focusing on some type of a conflict, because that's what story is all about, conflict and how to resolve the conflict. You can tell these stories that are quite compelling. And they don't have to be giant, massive stories about human tragedy. They can be little moments in human lives, but when told in a way that is captivating, can hold a reader and make a reader care about something as little as a meeting between two strangers on a park bench.
And in terms of your own influences for writers, I mean, you talked about from a young age wanting to be a writer. Are there particular writers who've inspired you along the way?
Many. I tell writing students that, you know, really the three legs of being a writer, one is to write every day and to just do it a lot. And the more you do it, it's like playing violin or anything, you get better. But two is to read a lot. And it's really hard to model voices as a young writer if you're not reading good writers. And then the third leg of that trinity, I say, is to get out and live a life, a full life, so you experience things that are worth writing about. So for me, you know, a bit ethnocentric, I imagine, but I was influenced a lot by mid-20th century American writers, Steinbeck, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, Hemingway, that school. And I was started in high school, and I was rereading a lot of these same works in college as an English major. And J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, as you know, I think every young person relates to that and the alienation he felt. And I think I read it four times in four different decades, and each time I got a little something different out of it. More recently, before I started my book, Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes was a book that I read and loved. What I took away from that is his ability to be very honest about his life, flaws and all, and to put it out there, to remove that armor, as I mentioned earlier. And that was an important lesson for me, that if you're going to write about your life, you need to tell it honestly, and you can't be afraid of putting yourself out there and also probably stepping on some toes of the people who are in your life, because they're going to be part of this story too.
And so you're still in America with your wife. You've got more dogs, I believe. Tell me a bit about the writing that you're doing at the moment.
We have two dogs right now, two Labrador Retrievers, and they're actually very calm, lazy, well-behaved dogs. So we finally got our just desserts as far as dogs who don't drive us to distraction. So I am in a fortunate space to be able to just kind of take my time to work on stories and writing that interests me. And I'm not really doing anything on deadline for publication right now. I've been playing around with a fictional work that's a long-term project that I work on for a bit, and then it sits for a bit. And who knows if it'll ever get out of my desk drawer, but I'm having fun with it because that's a new set of challenges for me. I'm so used to nonfiction. And I also have some nonfiction ideas that I'm advancing. And I do spend a lot of my time every day documenting my life. It served me well in the past. Both my two adult books both weighed heavily on, or depended heavily on, my journals. And so it's just part of my discipline each day. I journal. I write about my daily life. I'm writing about each day here in Dublin and at Trinity. 90% of it will never even be looked at again. But I want to know that it's there if I do want to go back and re-explore a certain part of my life. And just the process of writing each day about your life, I think, is a form of therapy. And it's a lot cheaper than therapy. Nobody's charging you $200 an hour. But it lets you, at least for me, it allows clarity. I sit down each night and I write about things that happened in my day. And just the process of putting them down helps me understand them better and the context of what they mean to me.
Well, it feels like life is moving ever faster and the amount of information. So that time for reflection, I think it really is an important thing. And can I ask you, in terms of your process, do you write in a notebook or do you type? Do you have post-its everywhere? Do you write at home or in cafes? What's the writer's process for you?
I'm almost 100% electronic. I'm virtually paperless at this point. I make printouts once in a while. So, yeah, I work on a laptop. My whole life is in my laptop. Everything music, photos, words, calendar. And I do carry a little notebook with me because I've learned the hard way that if you have a little moment of inspiration, something you want to remember, and if you don't write it down right there, especially if you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning and you remember that there was that moment of when you were walking through the park and you just cannot remember it. So I do that. As far as where I write, I have kind of a funny story about that. So after Marley and Me came out and we could afford it, we bought this very nice old stone farmhouse, 18th century in Pennsylvania, north of Philadelphia. And there was this old cottage, like a sort of a summer worker's cottage, and I renovated it to be my quote unquote writing studio. It's my man cave. But I thought it would be my writing studio. And it's a beautiful space, and the windows look out over a meadow.
Wow.
And it's got a little wood stove in it. And I get virtually no work done in there. It's just, I mean, it's almost too perfect. It's like, it's too distracting for me. And I think it's too close to the house. So what I tend to do is write in libraries, usually university libraries. For me, it's the right blend of quiet and energy, because everyone's quiet, but you're also surrounded by people who are working hard on their own work. And so there's this sense of creative energy there. And there's also a sense of people who are, as you said, butt in the seat. And so you're not the only one. When I'm sitting alone, I'm thinking, like, I'm so neurotic, like all writers are pretty neurotic. But I'm sitting there thinking, like, everyone else is out having fun except me. But if I'm in a library, especially at a university where there's a lot of brain power going on, I feel like I'm among my tribe of other writers and workers, and that works for me.
And tonight you're going to be talking to a lot of students, but also anyone who's interested who wants to come along to your open talk at Trinity College. Tell us a bit about what you're going to be talking about.
I'm going to be doing a sort of reading talk about the Marley and Me story. And then Professor Deirdre Madden, who's the head of creative writing here at Trinity, will be interviewing me, and we'll have like a back and forth, and then we'll be taking questions for the audience about that. So it's really kind of an evening of discussion about the book, about writing, about dogs, about family, and about all those issues that go into telling such a story. It's at 6:30 tonight, and tickets are available through Eventbrite, I believe.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining the art show today, and best of luck with the talk tonight.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.